hardest part of the talk is the opening word, because I'd much rather sit in the quiet of just being together, but that's not what this is about, so I will rise to the occasion. So tonight I want to talk about compassion. because as you will listen to the talk, I hope we all hear the possibility that lives within it. It's such a vibrant word, and we dull it somehow. It's what other people have, but we don't have enough of. And I want to express tonight that we all have sufficient amounts, that we're just looking in the wrong direction for access to it. And so I'm going to encourage us to really honor that fact and have confidence in that fact. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about the Birthing of the Heart series, which has gone on now since January. Because what we're attempting to do is sort of shift our locale from mind-centered consciousness to a heart-centered consciousness. And I've given at least a year and maybe longer, I just keep going as long as I think I have something to say about it, to encourage that shift to happen for all of us. Now let me explain what I mean by that shift, because sometimes we can get lost in the words that we're using, in the definitions of those words. Mostly we are in our mind-based consciousness. We are, through the course of our day and through the course of our work life, sort of driven with productivity standards and with the time on the clock, with a certain degree of pressure and stress, and an evaluation process. Either it's our annual evaluation, but on an ongoing basis, it's a moment-to-moment evaluation of how we're doing and how people around us are doing, and the pressures of the cooker of that, of the distance we have to go before we become better at what we're doing, and the evaluation and competition and comparisons that are immersed within all of that frame of reference. That's mind-based consciousness. Mind-based awareness. Heart-based awareness is the spiritual, it's the sacred. It's the content, it's the here and now. It's the immediacy of our life. It's where we sometimes find the repose, the ultimate repose, where we can actually settle, we can actually release, and there is no competition or no evaluation on how well we're releasing. We're not moving somewhere else in that moment of complete contentment, that whatever is occurring is sufficient. And that is a heart-based consciousness. That heart-based consciousness doesn't hold itself as being outside the stream of awareness. It lives within that stream of awareness. It doesn't evaluate and compete for whatever limitations are expressing themselves as part of the perfection of that immediacy. And to be able to move from a mind-based centered consciousness to a heart-centered consciousness is what the path of meditation is meant to do. It's to encourage us to re-examine the reason that we put ourselves under stress, because nobody does it to us. No boss, no neighbor, no spouse puts us under stress. We put ourselves under stress. And what is it that's driving inside of us that forces us to continually assert that stress is needed? That we have to be more productive and better people and on and on, and the forever of self-improvement. But we can't just, for most of us, we can't just decide that we don't want to be mind-based anymore, that we want to be heart-based, and just leave it. We have to prove to ourselves that mind-based consciousness doesn't work for us. It simply holds an edge we're not willing to embrace any longer. And then you look for alternatives. But every time you look for a better reality, you're still in mind-based reality, you see? Because there is no better reality than now. But the mind always thinks there is. It always looks beyond itself and says, well, it's up ahead. It's going to move in that direction. But when you live in heart-based reality, heart consciousness, there is no better moment ever, no matter what is occurring. No matter what is occurring. Than now. But we keep asserting the truth of a better future because we've lived with it. It's around us all the time within every advertisement. It's documented in our lives through our schooling. And so when we release our awareness and fall into the mechanics of life take us in that direction. They take us to the assertion that now is not good enough. That we have to work harder, be better. Whereas the heart consciousness says no. No. The state of mind says that. But the truth does not. And if you give the truth to the state of mind, you will be in movement with the state of mind, which is never perfect, which is never content. So if we invest in what our mind is saying to us in the moment, through all the varied states of mind that it produces, then it's just one sequence after another of trying harder. And so heart consciousness is really the heart consciousness of authenticity. Of what is authentically there. And as we move more into heart consciousness, we begin to release the strategies of mind-based consciousness. Those strategies also enter our spiritual work. And sometimes we can have a foot in one consciousness and a foot in the other. And we think we're moving in the direction of heart-based consciousness, but really, if you look beneath the surface, we are tense. We are not content with where we are spiritually. We are comparing ourselves and how we sit with each other. We're looking at this sitting and saying that our previous sitting was much better. We're looking at the mile markers of our spiritual life and see how much we have come along in the duration of the time we've been sitting. We allow mind consciousness into heart-based living because that's what spirituality is heart-based living. If you want to know where the sacred is, my friends, do not move because it's not somewhere else. And as long as we think that it is, it is the world of the mundane. It is the world of the mind that will show itself. And the mind is very convincing because you do see yourself improving. Because there's confirmation of its strategies. You see? But improvement is improvement from what? To what? When there was content before you started improving and content after, where have you moved to? It's our willing to acknowledge that fact, not follow the perpetuation of the need to induce that fact upon us. And the heart holds the source. It holds the ground of that understanding. So when we're talking about love and its many issues, there are many varieties, and I'll just speak about one of those varieties tonight. Love is not somewhere else. It's not an abstraction. It's either immediately found or it is not found, except in poetry or in books. Because it arises from quiet. Doesn't arise from doing. So if you're with me, then where we're going in heart consciousness is towards stopping, is towards being quiet, is towards arresting the need to move. And the way we form our practices is so important in relationship to which one of those consciousnesses we are moving toward. Because we can think we're really being spiritual, yet recondition the very fabric of our mental strategies back into us through that movement. And we have to be wiser than that. And so more important than anything for me is for you to know what you're doing when you're doing it, whether it's mind consciousness or heart consciousness, which does not mean that there aren't appropriate times to be mind conscious. If something has got the better of you and you're unable to be still with it, then bringing some skillful means, which is mind conscious means, to offset the load of that volatility. To compensate with mental qualities that which is arising, because we at that moment do not have the fortitude to be able to deal with that state of mind. We offset it, we unload a little bit of it. That's skillful means, and that's a valuable way for us to proceed. But we need to know what we're doing. Because when we're talking about love, there so easily, if you move into mind consciousness, love will be outside of you. It'll be distant. It'll be something to procure, to gain. And then we have lost love. It will never be found, no matter how far we chase it together. No matter how many wise people, including the Dalai Lama, you have in front of you, as long as you give your power of love over to that presenter, you sit devoid of love within mind consciousness. And to not know what is happening within the entire range of mind means that we're going to fall under the sway of mind consciousness. To not know what our intentions are, what motivates us. To have such a limited practice that you're only focused on what's in front of your nose, the tip of your nose, or the physical sensations that are arising. To not have a complete expanse of the mind and a complete understanding of what is arising in the mind means for certain we will fall under the sway of what is not being seen, and thereby secede our power to it, our power of immediacy, our power of love. Now I want to talk about compassion. Because in this day, looking in front of what's the array of calamity, I can't think of anything that gives me hope except compassion. To me, if there's going to be hope, if we're going to lift ourselves above the mess we have created, it's going to be through this word. And so we need to know this word, but we don't need to know it as a theoretical, philosophical point. We need to know it as an actual embodiment of ourselves. Not something we're running towards, but something that we're missing because we're looking away from it instead of at it and towards it. Compassion and suffering. What do we think love will do when it meets pain? You see? It becomes immediately obvious that it doesn't run from pain. It doesn't run from anything. It simply meets it. It doesn't meet it conditionally. It doesn't ask anything from the pain and suffering. Not even a remedy for it. It doesn't shield its eyes because it's too intense and overpowering. It simply meets it. And when that happens, that pain is experienced by us. And the only reason that some people seem to have it and others do not is because those that seem to have it have inclined their practice towards it. That they're not afraid of that as a subject matter, to take it on, to be a full embodiment. They don't skirt the issue of the suffering of humankind or of all beings. To take it on means to be absolutely oriented to life directly, without any wavering. Now, if the natural quality of us, when consciousness, love, meets suffering, is compassion, that's what the heart will always manifest, is compassion in relationship to the heart meeting suffering. If that's true, and there's the amount of suffering we have in the world, why isn't there more compassion? That's at the essence of what we want to discover. Why do we feel so devoid, so lifeless in ourselves when there is so much misery everywhere we look? It's because we turn away from the pain through a variety of different mind states. The mind state, the state of mental consciousness, interferes with the natural expression of love. We would rather go with the mind state. Let me take the Ebola crisis as an example. It's Sierra Leone is a wing on the map. People are dying there, but our children frolic very freely in our neighborhoods, do they not? You see the poem? What is she trying to say to us about the nature of love and casting humanity to a distance? And if we're asked about that, we will say, oh, that's too bad they're feeling that. I feel sorry for them. We lament the fact that they have to go through that plague. But it's a wing on the map. And so the best they get from us is pity, which is a sense of being on high ground when the poor victim is somehow below and disadvantaged. Maybe we'll even send some money, but we won't give our heart. And perhaps, as I noticed in myself, I see a picture of somebody laying in the dirt outside of a Ebola clinic because there's no room in the clinic, no bed, so they're lying in the physical dirt in their filth. For a moment, I actually do feel compassion. I actually do feel something about the common shared humanity of what this viewer and the victim have together. But then I get angry. I say, why doesn't somebody build some things so that these people can... And I get righteous, you see. Now what happens in that moment? My righteousness diverts my attention from the pain of that empathy. And I'm no longer feeling the open, shared humanity. And I have lost the compassionate response because my mind has moved away and embraced the wrathful anger, which I think would solve the problem. When actually what would solve the problem, if we stayed within the pain and then let the compassionate response be whatever it is, not the angry response, but the compassionate response. You see, this answers a very frequent question that I get about social activism. About, yes, you know, but there are lots of things out there and I'm angry that they're like that and I need to go out and do something. And we move towards solutions before we have properly oriented ourselves to the problem. We have lost our way because we are now moving in course with the anger response, the righteous response, the them and us, which is always the meat of a righteous action, and also of a pitied action, the thou and the me, the us and the them. And then there's the fear response. This one I've been witnessing when some Ebola victim lands in Dallas. Suddenly it's getting too close now. Now it's no longer a wing on the map. The victim is here. And then when the caregiver gets sick as well, suddenly we get fearful to the point where in some of the African countries, the victim, and because there's only a 70% mortality rate with the Ebola virus, 30% actually get better. But when they go back home, their neighbors are so fearful that in many examples, they won't let them back into their house. And then again, we have lost our way. We have missed the opportunity to meet the situation with a compassionate response. Now, it may happen because they're expecting some 10,000 more cases each week that this thing will spread. What are we going to meet it with? Are we going to dig a hole? I think the question should be asked now, long before that situation arises, and that we should be practicing. We should be moving our consciousness steadily in line with the openness to pain and suffering in the world, so that we'll have our answer when it does arrive. There's something beautiful about compassion because it's a flavor of love. Love on its own, when things are going well, in just an ordinary moment, is love. It's warm-heartedness. And then when suffering arises, love changes into compassion. And when somebody succeeds, then love changes into mudita, joy for that success. And when love looks out upon the varied troubles of the world, it does so not from volatility of emotions, but from a sense of steadied participation in life, embodied life, and that's equanimity. And so it has faces, it looks and feels very differently depending upon what's arising in relationship to it. But the compassionate response is the one we're most likely to turn away from, because it's where we feel most vulnerable, is in direct contact with pain. We don't have a response to that because our power has been taken away. When somebody's dying in front of us, which I had experienced many times, there's nothing I can do about the fact that he or she is terminally ill. My power has been taken away. And now I can either try to do varied activity around this person, get them, you know, something to drink or take care of their needs, or I can sit with them and honor the fact that there is nothing I can do. It doesn't mean that the other is unimportant. It's just that I cannot forget how to sit by a bedside if somebody is dying and not move from that and expect my compassion to be there when I get up. See how hopeless it is? It is hopeless. Hopeless in the sense that there is something that I egoically can do for this person. That's what pain does. It takes away our power to control it, either personal pain or pain in another. It leaves us completely impotent. That's the last stand of the ego. It can't stand that because it bases itself on what it wants to do or what it needs to do to feel useful. That's mind consciousness. So if I have a problem, I will surmount it. I will do whatever the texts tell me, and I'll look sufficiently into the Buddha's suttas to find the remedy for. But sometimes it doesn't require that. It requires us sitting still. In fact, ultimately, Dharma rests upon that, and so does the sacred. About us doing nothing in relationship to that problem. And the need to do something is the egoic empowerment that comes from that mind consciousness. The beauty of all of this is that intrinsically in us is a compassionate response. There is something embedded in each of our brains called mirror neurons. What that means is that when you see somebody in action, those mirror neurons actually are firing in the same area of your as if you were doing that action. And the accompanying emotional response is also being fired within our neurological makeup, merely by watching somebody else in their actions or in their pain. And so we actually have embedded within our system the capacity to know what other people are feeling. I love it. You see, the brain is representing the truth of oneness, but because a brain is differentiated and it holds mind consciousness, there has to be a neuron there to make that leap, to make that connection. And then we can say, well, it's not because there's oneness, it's because I have a mirror neuron that I'm feeling what you're feeling. But it's because the compassionate response arises, to me, proves the fact that there is oneness, that there is interconnectedness. What's interesting is that when you begin to know the depths of your own pain, when each of us know the depths of our own pain, we see suffering everywhere, even when that person is not physically expressing that suffering. If you've seen the pain associated with worry, and you see somebody worrying, they may not say they're in pain, they're worrying, but you know they are. And so the depth of the pain that we see when we have a deep understanding of the origins and causes of suffering begin to become ubiquitous everywhere. If you look out from the right vantage point, mostly what you see is people in pain. Now that sounds like a terrible existence. Who wants to go around with their mental mirror neuron firing all the time? But that's not what happens. It's not like that. What happens is that you get very quiet. And as you get quiet, your heart opens. And so if it's appropriate for you to involve yourself in that particular display of suffering, then you will feel what the other person is feeling. But the heart, the chest, as I say, has to be open. And many of us have such a barricaded chest. We have piled so much in front of it. So many excuses, so many ways of blame, of navigating ourselves off the chart of openness. So that we don't have to feel anything. And what's amazing to me, just let me get this point, make this point, because it's coming out so strongly. We project a wisdom when people look as if they're not feeling anything. We project somebody's wisdom as when they are in a state of unfeeling. We call it equanimity. Really, it's sociopathic. We will elevate the sociopath to the level of a saint because they aren't feeling, and we don't want to feel, so that must be some exalted state. And we do. There are some incredibly distorted practices that lead you to that conclusion. Because they have backed us away from a full embrace of life. And because we don't want any part of the richness of our emotional life, we will pursue those practices. For decades, we don't want to feel our hurt. We don't want to feel the depth of the suffering we hold within the tension of our past. The conclusions we formed about ourselves are vaulted, sealed, hermetically frozen. No air goes from them to us. So please tell me how to be non-feeling, we say, so that I don't have to ever live a life of a rich human being. But that's just the front. That's just accessing pain and all the ways that we feel humbled and powerless, and all of that comes up when we're willing to open up our hearts just to access pain. But there's another skill that's necessary in order to be completely open to pain, and that is we have to let pain go. We have to release and open the back so that it comes in and passes through us, but is not built or accumulated within that. And that's, for many people, the harder of the two doors to open. Because we sense that if we don't mull over what we just saw, that somehow we're not caring enough about what we just saw. That if our son, daughter, spouse, loved one is gone somewhere, then the need to worry proves that we are still have a relationship with that person and we're still a caring relationship with them. And so we practice bottling ourselves up and just continually revolving around with the same patterns and thoughts so that we can continue to feel what we think is so precious to feel. But what we don't realize is that true love is not a matter of mulling over something. It's an active expression of what's immediately there. So that if I can't be present to what's immediately there, I have no access to love. No matter how much I'm mulling over the previous moment, a hospice story. So I went into a house, a home, where the husband was dying and the wife, in her probably late 70s, was there to receive me. And as a hospice worker, you work with both halves of the family. You work with the patient, but you also work with the family as well. But as soon as I walked in the door, I just got this stream of negativity at me. Why would you were 5 minutes late? You told me you would be. I can't trust you. You know, what's going on here? This is terrible. You know, your service is lousy. You say you're going to do one thing and you don't do that. You do another. And meanwhile, my husband's is dying. None of you seem to. All of that. And from the first step into the home until I left it, that's what I got. So I got all that for an hour, right? So I walked out and I thought, as I was walking out the door, I said, well, that's it. That's the only visit I can make here. I mean, I'm beat. And anyway, I know she won't want me. So as soon as I open the door and step out of her house, she says, wait a minute. And I thought, oh, she's going to get the last word in. Okay, so I turned and she says, when are you coming back again? You see? So, okay, so now you're confronted with what the real... It's not personal. Her husband's dying, for God's sake. Her life is being turned on its head. This is an expression of pain for her. And it's coming out as blame, but who's free of that? And so then I actually, in that moment, even though I had an hour's worth of trauma, my heart warmed to her. And I said, I'll call you tomorrow. And she said, be sure to do that now. You see, no matter what comes at you, if it doesn't matter what the response is. Now, none of us are so spiritually oriented that it doesn't matter what the response is. But ultimately, it doesn't matter what the response is back from you. What matters is that we keep our heart open and not closed down. And what we have to do until that is mastered, which, believe me, I'll let you know when it happens to me, is to take time to have the compassion for our own pain and our own limitation and be able to take the necessary time away to reheal ourselves, to renew ourselves, so that we can go back out into the storm so that we can recover the next body, so that we can be present once more. And so when we do take that personal time, we're back in mind consciousness. That's okay. That's okay. And then I come back out again. And what the alternative is if you stay in that pattern longer than we're able, so that you start getting cynical. If I had not heard the closing remark of that lady, and then I called her, I would have gone, oh God, I don't really want to go back. This is like, who wants this? And I would have been like, cynical. Angry and cynical and just, let me get through this visit as quickly as I can so I can get to something that's more, I appreciate more. And I would have bypassed the whole thing, which I'm sure I did on many other visits to other people, to other patients, but not this lady. I learned my lesson with this lady. So the snow belt, you see. So meditation and compassion. I want to tell another story. There's a research study. I like this research study. Where people had 6 weeks of meditation. Okay? Now, there's a receiving room, like a doctor's receptive area, with say 10 chairs, and people would sit there, and then these researchers would bring in somebody who's disabled, who's walking, you know, with crutches or something, and after a repeated number of times, they calculated that only 10% of the people sitting in the chairs who were relatively healthy would get up and give their seats to the disabled person who was coming in. 10%. So they did that a repeated time. That was the average. Sometimes nobody would get up. So then they had a bunch of people do 6 weeks of meditation. And they had them go into this receiving room. And after the 6 weeks of meditation, they brought in somebody who was disabled. And they did that a number of times with different folks who had had these classes. And 60% of the meditators, who did not realize they were involved in an experiment at all, would get up and give their seats to the person who was disabled that came in. Something is happening. And nothing during those 6 weeks was even mentioned about, you know, the appropriateness of looking beyond yourself and thinking of somebody else that may need the chair more than you. That wasn't how the... It was like follow your breath or whatever it was, and just a. But something happened during those 6 weeks, and something is happening to each one of us here, unbeknownst to us. The power center of our mental consciousness is lessening. It's not being believed as strong. The struggles within it are being noticed more. There's more, less tension within our focused sense of self-concern. And we begin to sense, because we have been aware of our own pain, that other people may also have their pain, much like what we have now acknowledged to be in us. And we know the cause of that pain is not through blame and accusation, but through self-tension. And a growing sense of something collectively, collective happening rather than individuatedly happening. And all of those things in combination are happening to each of us here. But only if you know your way. If you practice only from the strategies of mental self-improvement, then the ego strengthens through meditation. It does not diminish. and the sense of one's priority of self increases, it doesn't diminish. So let us at least practice in relationship to the knowledge that we hold the love that we yearn to abide within. And let that love flow within us. Not from a sense of cultivating and acquiring and producing, but from a sense of relaxation and ease. From being willing to look at pain, acknowledge it, and open our lives to it, and also being able to release it and not hold on to it longer than its natural duration. And then we too, at some reception, dental reception, will get up for the person who comes in disabled. So be it, huh? Can we just sit for a moment or two? As we're sitting, I would like to just talk about a story or two. One is, I remember reading about somebody who was jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, and a police officer happened to be on the scene at the time. And he risks his life by grabbing the person who was jumping off the bridge, saving the person's life from suicide, but risking his own so that both of them almost fell off the bridge. And a crowd of people gathered around him, the police officer, afterwards, and asked him why he would ever risk his life for someone he didn't even know. And he said, I could not have lived another day if I had not tried to save him. You see, this response is very close to us. It's very near. It's not a logic. Logic will not take you in that direction. I remember being a young boy and watching on the news, someone trying to escape from East Berlin to West Berlin, and made it to the wall where this person was shot. And so he was leaning halfway on the west side with his legs dangling on the east side of the wall. And I remember a whole bunch of people gathered around watching this person die on the wall without helping that person because they were afraid they would get shot. And I remember, and I don't know how old I was probably less than 10 years old, thinking to myself, I would jump up there and try to save that man. And it wasn't a thought that came from the maturity of an adult. It came from the ripened maturity of the compassion that belies itself in terms of age. We each have a compassionate response within us. And we can make our culture much richer, much more holistic. There was a book written about disaster communities. And this book review of that book, called A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. And it's written by Rebecca Solnit. And the question was that she posed herself, what forms when there is disaster all around? And her answer, this is a quote, is strangely and powerfully hopeful. She doesn't long for disasters. They are, she writes, most basically terrible, tragic, and grievous. But they are not just that. As she proves with inspired research, disasters often produce remarkable temporary communities, paradises of a sort amid the rubble, where people acting on their own and without direction from authorities manage to provide for each other. In the wake of an earthquake, a bombing, or a major storm, most people are altruistic, urgently engaged in caring for themselves and those around them, strangers and neighbors, as well as friends and loved ones. These remarkable societies suggest that, just as many machines reset themselves to their original setting after a power outage, so too human beings reset themselves to something altruistic, communitarian, resourceful, and imaginative after a disaster. That we revert to something we already know how to do. The possibility of paradise is already within us as a default setting. Now let's sit. If there is hope, in my opinion, it is through this word. It is that close. Salvation for humanity and for the world, I think, is that close. Thank you. Oh, thank you. So if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to see what I can do with them. Yes.
Can you say more about the part of not letting the suffering just settle over from you, but letting it happen?
Very, okay, so can I say something more about not just letting the response that just happened settle within you, but keep it moving. What happens, you see, is the opening of allowing that come in is heart consciousness. You're open, you're receiving the difficulty that's in front of you, right? But what happens is that feels really overpowering. And sometimes it feels really good to feel that connected to life. And so then what happens is that we shift to mind consciousness that starts embroiling that in thought and in memory and kind of, it just keeps mulling over it. And it won't let it just move through. It sort of ponders and prolongs whatever the message was. So if it was a sense of real heartfelt, genuine caring, then we may spend half the day thinking about how important that was or so glad I felt that. But in doing so, we've cut ourselves off from feeling what the next moment is. We have really regurgitating the past, over recycling the past, are we not? So the way through that is to let whatever the impact is, but then there's another moment in which the next contact has its own impact. It may be less intense or less vibrant or less pleasant, but it also can be met with the same love connection. Perhaps it's not compassion this time. Perhaps it's just warm-heartedness. You see? But love needs that active expression. It needs immediacy to be renewed. And as soon as we make it into a mental frame of reference by mulling over it, we've stepped out of the active response of compassion and are now back into the memory of compassion, which is very far from it. Is that it? Okay, all good. So we'll have discussion on this next week. It is my belief that the discussion is as important as the passive talk, because we engage, you know, it gets us going. This is an embodied practice, and I'm going to give a talk on this, by God, where you have to move into it. Your cells have to change. It can't be just, oh, that was a really interesting talk, I'll go back and think about it, because it all stays external. It has to become a part of our vibrancy, of our aliveness itself, which is the action component. And that's what's known as wise action, integrating the concepts into the very expression of our heartbeat. Okay, so thank you.